This is KSQD Santa Cruz. From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
Annie B. Parson is my guest. She's an award-winning choreographer and co-founder of Big Dance Theater. She has worked with everybody, including Bowie and David Byrne and St. Vincent and many others. And she's just published a book called The Choreography of Everyday Life. Annie B. Parson, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was deceived by the slim size of your little book, because as soon as I finished it, I started it again. there's a lot in to take in here, but was that the intention? Is it like circular? Does the end require that you start again, like in a circular dance, like the Hora?
Gary, that is such a beautiful idea. I can't believe I didn't think of that myself. It was not intentional. I love that two things. One is that you're circling back, and that's just such a great form, the circle. And secondly, that you wanted to, and that you're thinking of it as a dance.
It as soon as I finished it, I was thinking, well, wait a minute. I got a lot out of it, but I'm not sure I got everything. And then I realized that the end and the beginning are sort of the same scene.
Yeah, that's true.
So how did you come to write this book?
It's a little bit lucky, just luck. I think that I'm working on a different book that's sort of a collaborative project on the subject of dance history from sort of a poet's perspective, like not academic, but from a choreographer's perspective. And I had invited 12 other choreographers to write with me, and I was trying to find a publisher, and I went to Verso, and the publisher there said that she was interested in doing something with me, but not something that sort of large, something different, more personal. And did I have a book? And I said, no, but I could. And she said, I said, what are you thinking about? She said, just write something. And the way she said it, you know, it's like some of the great teachers that just make it sound so easy that they're almost like throwing you a ball and you just kind of catch it and say, oh, all right. Here I go. And that quality, I think, of her tone, which, as you know, in the book, tone is a really big issue for me. That tone just sort of filled me and was the juice, I would say, or the nature of the writing. I just wrote something.
Well, yeah. In the book, you talk about, you know, tone in dance, and you say that it's like a neglected aspect of dance. But can you define it? What is tone in dance?
It's muscularity. It has an effect that's very indefinable in that world of strange things called energy. But in the practical side of it, it's how much effort you put into your muscles. So, for instance, when you show like a flexed muscle and you look really, really strong, there's some tension. There's some strength there. That's a kind of a tone. Or if you flip your hand really lightly to say, oh, it doesn't matter, that has a different sort of tone because of the muscularity of the movement is very light. So that's just two examples of, you know.
Oh, well, I can envision it.
Yeah, good.
Aside from like a biography of a famous dancer or a history of dance, how do you write about dance?
Well, I think I just did. I mean, I wrote about it as a person that was sort of observing the civic body, the citizen body, in a sense, which was, you know, really good timing because of COVID, because the citizen body was being re-choreographed every day and re-costumed. And I wrote about it from the perspective of how we use space. I mean, I could write about dance itself. I wrote a little bit about dance itself in talking about Trisha Brown. But really, you can talk about anything from the perspective of movement.
My wife is a New Yorker, so when I'm not, I grew up in L.A. So when we go to New York and we're walking on the street in Manhattan, she has this thing that she does. And I'm always, I end up 10 or 15 feet behind her trying to catch up to her because she she has no problem weaving through the crowd, whereas I do.
I know it's a real thing, and I'm happy that you notice it, because I think each city does have a civic rhythm. Our rhythm is very sort of glide and step, and it's very quick. Our RPM is pretty fast here. And when people are frustrated with tourists, it's not just that they're stopping and looking and that's, you know, stopping our swimming, but it's also they come from places with different rhythms, and those rhythms are nice too. They're just different. So that there's a bit of a cacophony that's not so practical.
You mentioned that in New York, people still walk to get somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely. We walk to get somewhere. We walk every day to get somewhere. And I think that's what probably separates us from most people.
Yes. I like to walk, but there's nowhere you could walk to here. I mean,
yeah. That may be the essential difference between New York and L.A., and that your small kinesphere space of your car creates a bubble that separates you from the rest of the citizen body. Whereas we not just walk through many, many people that are walking with purpose and task, but we also get on this moving vehicle that's very packed with other human bodies of all different types. And there's a lot of choreography going on in the subway.
Including the guy who says showtime and then.
Exactly. And he does something pretty awesome. I mean, you can tell I still like New York.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so how did you fare during the pandemic, and how are things now?
Oh, well, I fared pretty well because luckily I had work, as a teacher on Zoom. And I also was writing this book, which was completely exciting for me. I'd never written, I have done books, but not written a book, more like imagery. So I was interested in the pandemic from that perspective. And secondly, and again, I'm going to sound like a New Yorker that's, you know, a happy New Yorker, is we kind of had history on our doorstep here. We saw everything. You know, we were right in the middle of the protests. We were in the middle of the clapping. We were in the middle of all the changes of trying to deal with a very dense population in the public space, as we just talked about. So there was no car to get into or, you know, and so it was pretty interesting. It was a pretty interesting time, as long as we weren't, you know, but I don't want to say we weren't scared of COVID and stuff, but I loved watching sort of New Yorkers make decisions around how to pass each other, how to stand in line, how to shelter in place, you know, which is a choreographic directive.
Shelter in place. Well, yeah. So I think one of the complaints my wife says is that now that the pandemic is lightening and people are getting back to stuff, it's as if it never happened. People don't want to discuss it or learn from it or process it.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, one thing I realized in the theater, I'm doing an opera right now and opens Tuesday. And I want to say to the audience, you think that all these pieces that you're seeing live are that the whole issue of COVID is over, but everything you're seeing was affected by COVID and it's not back to normal. You know, we still rehearsed in masks, which is very odd when you're in an opera working in dance. We had many, many rehearsal periods canceled because of COVID. We didn't get an out-of-town run, which has never happened at the Met with a premiere. We're seeing something that's, you know, very much being run for the first time with all its kinks. And we are still affected by COVID. Absolutely. On the other hand, it does feel great to be very boosted and not feel, you know, as worried.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that happened during the pandemic that was, for me, like an oasis, a treat, a delight, was David Byrne's American Utopia was on TV. And it was one of the greatest things I've ever seen. I didn't get a chance to see the show when it was on stage, although I've seen, I saw Talking Heads quite a few times, and I've seen David Byrne solo a couple of times, but that show was unbelievable, and the film was absolutely the greatest thing. And so tell me, what, how did you get involved in it, and what did you do in it?
Well, I have been choreographing for David for, I think, 12 or 15 years. So by the time he wanted to make American Utopia, I had choreographed maybe three of his live shows, the one with Brian Eno, and then the one with St. Vincent, and then his musical, Here Lies Love, and a lot of little things in between. So when he brought me into to American Utopia, he said about four or five things to me, sort of as the beginning sort of elements of the piece, which were he wanted to be everybody in gray suits. He wanted no wires or cords on stage and no messy water bottles or platforms, all the ubiquitous stuff that's part of the sloppy world of 70s rock and roll. He was like, we don't need it. He had figured out how to do that, you know, because all the pedals, drum pedals, everything, guitar pedals, everything's off stage. So he said everybody would be carrying their own instrument. They'd be free to be choreographed for the entire show. And the stage would be completely empty and they'd be wearing gray suits.
And they should.
Well, I mean, and then I was like, and they're going to be barefoot, right? And he was like, they need to be if they're going to be dancing for 2 hours. And he's like, good, great, let's do it.
But that was your thing.
Yeah. So that was part of, I don't think I could have made American Utopia in the amount of time that we had without having worked with him forever. It's like one long piece, as far as I'm concerned, you know, and like a lot of the stuff like Road to Nowhere, you know, a lot of these pieces, I had already, his songs, I had made a draft of in other iterations. It was great. And then, so my role was to choreograph the entire thing. And it was then, after that, when Spike Lee came in to make the film, Spike Lee said, the whole thing is choreography. And I'm going to try to figure out how to film this, which, you know, is very difficult to film dance in a way that you feel the feelings that you feel in live movement. I'm going to try to film this so you feel like you're there. And he did. I mean, I was blown away by it.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. If you're just joining us, my guest is Annie B. Parson. Her book is called The Choreography of Everyday Life.
It's so difficult to take a Broadway show and capture it in any way other than sitting there and watching it. I mean, I have some videos that people have made with their phones or whatever of Broadway shows, and they're unwatchable. You can't, there's no way to transfer it. Although I did think that the film of Hamilton, which was also on during the pandemic, was really great, but I just was entranced by American Utopia, and I feel like I saw it, even though I saw it only on film.
Yeah.
And only on my TV. But it was, I just thought it was remarkable. So congratulations on
Thank
that.
Thank you. I mean, some of that goes to Ellen Kouris, who was the DP. And she, before we started, you know, she places all the cameras. And I mean, with Spike Lee, but, you know, she's just, she said to me, I want to take you out for dinner and I want to talk about choreography. And I said, you want to talk about the choreography? And she said, no, I want to talk about choreography. And I just thought that was so cool, because it was like, first, she's saying, I just want to understand what choreography is. Like, I need to wrap my head around it as an art form. And then she said, we'll have all the dinners where we talk about the choreography, you know, song to song to song to song, what's going on. And she was she's a very profound thinker. And she had 13, I feel like, cameramen. And each one was handpicked by her and Spike Lee as the greatest, you know, people that you could have. And each one at different times during the shooting came up to me and said how thrilled they were. And it was just like one of those magical experiences where everybody was happy to be there. And the result was so, so unusual.
David Byrne seems to be having a lot of fun in the show. What kind of a person is he to work with?
He's a great artist. I mean, he's a great citizen artist first. Every single show that we did, because this was a show that was just a touring show before it went across the world for a year. Every single show that was in the American continent, he had the voting registration sign up. He's, you know, a very, very extraordinary citizen of this country. His politics, you know, he's not a person that's telling you how to feel or to vote. He's sort of the opposite, but he's very serious about being a part of what's happening and nudging it in the right direction. So it's inspiring to be around somebody like that. He can do so much. He's able to accomplish so much because he works his ass off, and he's always the first one in the room. You know, I work with a lot of musicians and they tend to be late.
David's early.
David's early. He's a great artist, obviously. He's a great aesthetic thinker, and he's a person that you can't quite, what'd you say? As an artist, I want to say that I was so drawn to his music when I first heard it, like, you know, when we all first heard it. For its irony, but he would say that's not what's going on, I think, or not anymore. He's very dynamic in his thinking. And I think that's why he's survived, is he doesn't ever want to do things that what he calls retreads, even with dance. Because I said to him that, you know, the audience knows a lot of the songs, and it's really beautiful that it's kind of a sing-along in certain parts, like in our culture, that's sort of our folk art, is that we kind of sing along with the popular songs that we grew up with and so forth. But I said, I would wish that we could have that with dance. And I said, there are some movements that you have done in your career, because, you know, I'm sure, you know, I think he's an incredible dancer. And some of those movements, I think we should reiterate in this show, because people know them the way they know lyrics, and they remember them, even if they don't know they remembered them. And so I'd like to have that kind of bringing back that kind of material, like with lyrics. And he said he didn't want retreads. And I was like, just one. And so I got him. So I got him to do the stumble in Once in a Lifetime.
Oh, the stumble. Yes, I love the stumble.
Yeah. But I mean, that's very David. He's always finding new solutions for things. And he's not trying to save himself. You know, he's really alive to everything that's going on. I see him all over the city seeing work. I always have at the most downtown avant-garde dance. He knows a lot about dance. Dance performances and music performances on his bike. So, yeah. Keeping it fresh.
Well, I think all the best artists, the greatest artists, are ones that don't want to repeat themselves and always want to move forward and do something new.
They want to, but are they successful at it? Because it's quite rare.
Yeah, it's hard to do it, especially if you have a bunch of fans who want you to do your...
It's true, and producer.
Yeah. So what about that in dance? Are there people... No, I don't know a lot. I mean, the dancers that I know are dancers that I saw in the movies, like Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly and Sid Charisse and so on. Are they sort of required to do their greatest hits when they dance, or is it?
Well, you know, dance is so marginalized that you're talking about a very small group of people. Yeah. I mean, there's very, very few choreographers that I think you could name, as you just said, that have greatest hits. So They may have greatest hits, but people aren't so aware of them.
Yeah.
So it just doesn't compare to music. But sure, like Alvin Ailey, you know, everyone wants him to do Revelations. It's his signature work and it is a great piece. But it's not like, you know, I remember reading about Lorca, like everyone, when he would do a poetry reading, wanted him to read the one about so I took her to the river believing she was a maiden, but she, you know, that poem. And he didn't want to read it. And it reminded me of David, like he just didn't want to do it. Like he wants to do new stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. With choreography, and this is just my ignorance, there must be a notation of that in, you know, when they said, when they did the new West Side Story and they said, well, they had to do Jerome Robbins choreography. How do they, is there a notation that says this is what you do in this?
There wasn't. In the 30s, I believe, Rudolf Laban in Germany developed a notation called Laban notation. It's very, very coarse. It only describes certain things. It's not like musical notation where it's really quite in depth. It only can show you what your feet are doing and what your arms are doing. So it's no, I would say there is no notation that's really very good. And then with the onset of video, people learn material through video, which is also very poor because it doesn't have the dimensionality of a Spike Lee movie with 13 cameras. Mm-hmm. The greatest way to learn, the only way to learn choreography well is from another person. And in that passing down, many things happen. There are changes that are made, but there's a embodiment that is shared. And that's really the way it's been passed down. And that's some of the beauty of it, but it's the sadness of the ephemerality of it as well.
How did you become a choreographer? And is that something that you can, tell me, how did you become a choreographer?
I studied it in college. I studied it in high school. You can study it. It has elements like in the book, you know, I talk a lot about compositional elements. Just like in painting, you know, you can and in music, you can study the compositional elements. There's a big, big difference between it being a dancer and a choreographer. They're two different kinds of study, just the way that an actor isn't necessarily a playwright. I mean, you know how different those two roles are. Playwright thinks in a completely different way than an actor thinks. Not to say an actor has never been a playwright and a playwright's never been an actor, but it's rare. And that's very true with composers and musicians as well.
So a choreographer doesn't have to be a dancer. You don't have to be able to do the dance steps that you're
choreographing. No, you don't. I mean, many are, but usually you want to hire somebody better than you. I mean, I studied 20 years of ballet. It's not like you can be a choreographer and not study dance. You would need to understand dance, but you might not have all the gifts that a great dancer would have, you know. And dancers think very differently about movement than choreographers think about movement. Choreography is not steps. Choreography is an Uber idea. For instance, with this opera I just did, it's based on The Hours by Virginia Woolf. It's not about what the choreography, yes, there are steps in it, but the first bit of choreography is what am I doing as a choreographer in this opera? And that's the artistic voice, essentially.
So if you conceive of a dance,
yeah.
Do you conceive of it because you know your dancers, or do you find the dancers then who can execute your conception?
Either. It could work either way. I have a company, I used to have a company of people that I worked with a lot. So I would conceive of pieces with them in mind. Like sometimes a playwright or a movie writer will have an actor in mind. But often, like in American Utopia or in this opera I'm working with, we hire people. You know, you're looking for people that will suit it. When I make movement for David Byrne, I'm thinking very much about his body, that I can do it. You know, like I'm by myself in this room that you're seeing me in right now, listening to the music for the first time. And I It's all about David and the way he moves, which I know very well.
Gary Shapiro, this is From the Bookshelf. If you're just joining us, we're chatting with Annie B. Parson. She's an award-winning choreographer and the co-founder of Big Dance Theater. She has created choreography for opera, pop stars, marching bands, television, theater, ballet, symphonies. She choreographed the film American Utopia by Spike Lee and starring David Byrne. She's written a book. It's called The Choreography of Everyday Life.
You work with David Bowie, I read.
The last thing he made was a musical. Well, the last thing he made was Dark Star.
Right.
At the same time, he had written a musical, strangely enough. It's called Lazarus. It was kind of based on The Man Who Fell to Earth. And it was directed by Ivo van Hove. It's a great, great director. And it was co-written. Well, it was written by Bowie. And some people sort of thought it was a jukebox musical kind of thing. Mm. But I don't know if he would have thought that. He was not at rehearsal. Well, he was a little bit. He wasn't not ever there, but he was quite sick at that time because he died in January, I believe, and we made it in the fall. So he was around a little bit.
So you weren't surprised when he died because
you I was because nobody told us in rehearsal. It was a secret.
Yeah.
I just thought he was busy. Mm. He did look extremely thin. Although still glamorous, but choreographing to Bowie was fantastic. It was fantastic. I had never had the chance to do a really deep dive into his music. I'd always been a fan, which is totally different than choreographing to somebody, as you can imagine.
Yeah, you have to really get into it if you're going to.
Oh my gosh. You know, you have to find your way into it is the thing. Like I found my way into David's work many years ago. Through choreographing, you know, found like, what is my voice in relation to this music as opposed to anybody else that would choreograph it? With Bowie, it was my first time really doing that. And I just cannot tell you how cool it was for me. It was really rich.
Well, he was amazing.
He was very theatrical. And that was part of what was in my mind was he was a great dancer, obviously. And he was a very theatrical in every sense of the word, performer. That was underneath everything for me when I was working on that musical.
I've seen St. Vincent in concert a couple of times, and I think she's similar in that I don't think she's the person that she portrays. Is that true?
Yeah. I think she would say that. I mean, I never saw her before I worked with her. So I think she has gotten more and more interested in theatrical elements in her work to a point now where she's very disappeared into her work. And Bowie does come up. The very first thing I did with her was with David Byrne, their show they did together. And she was herself in that.
Yes.
Then the next shows we did together, she wasn't. The costuming and her sense of, she's a real chameleon and she's a bit of a, almost like an old fashioned music hall sort of performer. She's got a really elfin sort of wit. I think she's a great performer. I mean, beside her extraordinary music, she's got
really well,
super interesting performer. She's got a million ideas like David. She's very intellectual. Yeah.
Yeah, easy to work with, fun to work
with. So much fun. So cool.
That's fantastic. Well, I want to know a little bit more about the Big Dance Theater. What is that?
So that was a company that I started when I was young with my husband and another performer named Molly Hickok. And the three of us started this company like, we want to make our own work. And it's going to combine theater and dance. We're going to use text from plays. We're going to use text from literature. We're going to use found text. We're going to have really complex choreography. It's going to be like, You know, that's why I use the word big. It was sort of based on Laurie Anderson's Big Science, that that album had just come out, and I love the title. And then we luckily were able to stay together with we're still working, and we're able to make pieces for the Brooklyn Academy of Music here. And we've done quite a bit of touring in Europe. So it's been a great way to develop my work and to develop these ideas of theater and dance. And that is where David first saw my work, David Byrne.
Mm. So you were discovered.
I was discovered. Yeah. I told you he sees everything.
And you've worked with Laurie Anderson too. I like
it. I did. I worked with Laurie Anderson in the very early 90s on one thing. And it was a kind of a cool video that there were three women in it, and she and her, and she was very like a little, I don't know, she's got such a great performative quality, you know? And I just made one dance for her.
Neat. I like her a lot. She's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, so now you've written a book. Is this something that you're going to be doing? You're going to write?
Well, the thing I love about it is that I love, it doesn't, what we call open, meaning that, you know, I do these shows, they take forever. And except for American Utopia, they close very quickly in dance. So you can run things 4 or 5 days and it's over, even though you work 2 years on it. Now, with my book, you know, if somebody could read it in 2 years, you know, they're busy right now.
40 years or 100 years.
Right? And that's so nice. Like there's no due date. And I really love that. And it's small and it's light and people are really enjoying it. So I don't know, you know, if I'll ever do anything like that again, but I have to say that it was in my mind, it was a choreographic project. I mean, you can see it on the page that it's sort of laid out choreographically and it's got like percussive elements, you know, like the short lines and the long lines. And so I guess I would just have to have another idea.
Lots of cool little pictures.
Yeah, yeah.
And diagrams. I mean, it's all in there. Tell me about the cover. On the cover, there's a guy carrying a little girl on his shoulders and you're seeing it from the back. What is that?
Well, the cover actually didn't come from me. The designer picked it and I liked it because it shows these limbs and legs, like the arms and legs are all intertwined as if this is like a four-armed human being or eight-armed, eight-legged or something. It just has, it's a choreography that just happened in an impromptu way between this parent and child. You feel the weight of the child's body on the shoulders. Weight is a really big part of choreography. And shape is a very big part of choreography, one of the major elements. And yet it's just a very mundane activity, is that, you know, we choreograph with other people all day long. So when she showed it to me, I felt like it was a good one. Do you like it?
I love it. It's great. It's beautiful. And good. It's a black and white, but I also love the red and yellow of your lettering and the way it wraps around them. It's really lovely. I have a couple of questions about dance. My mom and I had an ongoing argument. She likes to watch Dancing with the Stars and So You Think You Can Dance and all of those dance programs that are on TV. And I don't like to watch them, but I do like to watch dance in the movies. I'm a big movie fan. I love movies and I love musicals. And I say that that's not dancing what they're doing, because it's more like gymnastics than dance. But I think I'm wrong now that I've read your book.
Well, the difference I would say between gymnastics and dance is that one has an aesthetic properties and one doesn't. In gymnastics, they try to add some style or whatever, but it's really about the tricks, which is really cool. I love tricks too. It's about the athleticism of these bodies performing these extraordinary tricks. Choreography is almost the opposite. It's really not about tricks. I mean, there are tricks of like stopping time you can do that with choreography, or, you know, like in that image, add arms to a body with, you know, things like that. But it's really, really not about that. It's really more about aesthetics. It's much closer to poetry than gymnastics, I would say, like sort of a poetry of the body, bodies. I've never seen Dancing with the Stars, but I'm interested in all these, what I think of as almost folk dance forms that have become very popular now. I'm not like a TikTok person or anything like that, but I love that they exist. Like, to me, TikTok is sort of a domestic folk art form where people make their own dances, often on their beds.
Yeah.
Or in their backyard, like in their own little theaters, they create these dances with quote unquote moves, and they're expressing something.
And they're only 15 seconds.
Yeah, I think it, right. And it has, and the duration also is a choreographic element, because duration is a choreographic decision. How long should something take? I dance in a buto company, which is a Japanese and Korean form that's in slow motion. So it's in very slow motion. And wow. When I asked the choreographer, it's a form that arose out of World War II. It sort of grew out of the ashes of the destruction of World War II in Japan. And I asked the choreographer, why are we going so slowly? And she said, is a tree slow? Sorry, I gave you that moment of silence.
A tree is just as slow as it needs to be.
Exactly. And so we decide on duration, on tempo, on rhythm, on these questions of length, and they create the content, the meanings. They're meaning makers, all these choreographic elements. So when TikTok is so brief, of course it comes from the social media, you know, whatever algorithms and stuff, but it also creates meaning that it's brief. These choreographers, it would be very hard for them to sustain what they're doing, and so they figure out ways. It supports them in a sense, and it also creates this sort of sense of things moving very quickly and having almost an anecdotal quality, almost like a little whisper of something, rather than this is important, this is weighty, you know, this is going to take time, this is a tome, that kind of length. So I'm really interested in all these forms and all their limitations and how those make meaning.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever felt comfortable as a dancing. I'm not a good dancer. And here's what I hold responsible. When in the era before my time, there were dances like, you know, the foxtrot and the boogie woogie, whatever it was. And then right when I was a little kid, there were dances like the twist and the mashed potato and the frug. And then kind of when I was ripe for going to shows and things, it was that period of time where nobody was dancing anymore. They were just standing around flailing their arms and legs in a free form kind of way. And I didn't attend any dance classes. I mean, I think we had square dancing when I was in school as a kid. But that whole era of, you know, just
playing tennis without a net.
Yeah. And, you know, I think when you mentioned the TikTok, I think now they're kind of getting back to having.
Yeah. But I would say that, you know, what's interesting, as you said that, I was thinking, you know, this whole period, and it's still true, like in raves and stuff, where there's no dances, so to speak, that it's quote unquote free form, is that was very expressive of an idea that it was the rule breaking, the moment of rule breaking. They didn't want to do the dances they were taught, the foxtrot or the whatever, the twist, the this, that. No, reject form and just let me be quote unquote free. Well, in dance, there is no free. And that's what you were experiencing. You know, you had nothing to hold you. So if you weren't comfortable to just move around freely, quote unquote, freely, you felt lost and unsupported. That's what form does. Form supports you. It's like, let's say I gave you a wine glass and I said, here, have a glass of wine. And then you're like, where's the wine? There's nothing without the wine. But if I gave you the wine and there's no wine glass, it just spills all over the place. So you were like the wine without the wine glass. It just Nothing. You need both. You need form and content. They support each other and they give meaning to each other.
Yeah, you can't sing if there's no song.
Right. And you'll see in American Utopia, whether you, I don't even know if I could speak to this, but there's so much form in it. And the musicians were very used to, you know, like just moving around freely while they, and I was like, there's no free in choreography. It does. It's just, it's all about form.
Just to go back to your history for a minute. So you studied it in school and you learned to do it. What was the first time that you sat in an audience and watched people do a dance that you had choreographed? And what was that like?
I got a letter from, I had a pen pal in Japan and when I was in high school, and she somehow wrote me a letter when I was in college and I was in a choreography class. And I was surprised because we had been, I thought we weren't in touch anymore. And she wrote me a letter and it just was very rhythmic. I don't know. I just remember the rhythms of it. And I thought, I'll choreograph this. So I choreographed her letter. And I taught it to somebody. I think I was, you know, at the beginning of college. And I think that was the first time that I kind of watched somebody do a dance I made. And it was pretty interesting. And I thought, really would like to be on the outside of this rather than on the inside. I'm really interested in this. I was also studying visual art and painting. So that was part of it. But professionally, yeah, I think I first choreographed, you know, it was DIY. Like I would get a bunch of people together and see if they would agree to sit in a studio with me and let me make things on them. And then sort of just try to get somebody to let me perform it for an audience. You know, it's not very big deal.
Is it like a director? Do you give your dancers notes afterwards and say, oh, you...
Many. Endless notes.
and what do you say? You didn't dance that well enough?
No, they're more like, aha, that would be so funny. No, they're more like, can you put more weight through your right big toe on the second step? And can there be more lightness at the top of your head when you enter, and can you, you know, things like that.
Wow. And do dancers get...
it's usually about quality. Yeah.
And are they open or are they...
I have seen everything. Yeah. I've literally seen everything. I've seen everything from the performers who love notes, want to deepen, want to know more. Now that we have an audience in, give me more notes so I can understand it better and find my own way. And I have had performers that literally I cannot give a note to. I mean, not allowed. Yeah.
You're defensive about it.
Hmm.
It's just fascinating. Thank you for indulging all of my questions. Your new book, it's called The Choreography of Everyday Life. And it's new, but you could read it 20 years from now and it'll still be new. Or
I hope so.
30 years from now. And I'm in the middle of reading it for the third time. And the author is my guest, Annie B. Parson. Thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Choreographer Annie B. Parson. Her new book is called The Choreography of Everyday Life. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf.
From the Bookshelf, contributor Alyssa Warren joins us again this week, and she is one of the people who brings me great authors to From the Bookshelf, and she's the president of Alyssa Warren PR, which specializes in author publicity. She's also a professor at Emerson College in Boston, and we're happy to have her here. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi, Gary.
What have you been up to?
I've been reading a lot. What have you been up to?
Reading. I like to read, too. We have so much in common.
I also turned in my final grades, which felt really good, I have to
say. Congratulations. You're on break.
End of the semester. I'm on break. Yes.
Yeah, you can read a lot.
I can. And I have. And I do.
What have you been reading?
Well, I read a wonderful novel by a guy named Douglas Bauer called The Beckoning World. It's published by the University of Iowa Press, and it came out in November. The Beckoning World spans the first half of the 20th century and follows Earl Dunham from the age of 12 to his early 50s, We meet him as a boy about to flee his abusive coal miner father for a life in the world, the beckoning world. Freed and on his own and not yet 20 years old, he resumes the only work that he has known. His weeks are comprised of 6 days mining coal, and from early spring until late fall, Sundays in the light playing baseball. Baseball is his love. Camp teams, pickup games, all that matters to Earl is that he plays, that he pitches. Until the day a major league scout happens on a game, signs Earl to a contract, and he begins a life, a dream he had no idea was a life a man could even dream. But of course, dreams sometimes suffer a lovely abundance. And in Earl's case, her name is Emily Marchand. She's a dreamer in her own right, and she's a young woman who sets out to learn something about the world. Their love is immediate and deep, but with it comes a heartbreaking complication, for their respective worlds that beckon them are very, very much in conflict. The book takes us across the breadth of the continent, and the story gathers together a cast of characters that includes Emily's farmer parents, a pair of weathered prairie figurines, as the author writes, baseball's greatest legends, Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, and a large-hearted Pullman steward offering aphoristic wisdom. And there are countless other wonderful, memorable characters in this book, not the least of which is the 1918 Spanish flu. It really becomes a character in its own right, and it takes on this sort of vivid spectral form. And at the center of this whole book, all the baseball, all the illness, is Earl and Emily's relentless love. Now, it's not just me saying that this is a wonderful book. It's been blurbed by authors like Richard Bausch and Dennis Lehane, A-list writers, talking about this other A-list writer, Douglas Bauer. Loved this book.
Oh, of course, I love baseball. And I'm interested now in the flu because of our own pandemic, such a that was the last big one, I guess. And Bauer, he's also a nonfiction writer as well, right?
That's correct. He has written nonfiction as well, and he is a professor too. He teaches at Bennington College's writing seminars, their MFA program, and incidentally, not coincidentally, that's where I got my MFA, and he was actually a professor while I taught there. Now, I was in their poetry program. He did fiction, so I didn't really get to interact with him other than like in the cafeteria, but nicest man ever, and was just revered by all of the other professors there at Bennington. So yes, he does nonfiction, he does fiction, just a little bit of everything, but not poetry, which is what I wanted him to do so I could have him as my professor.
I didn't know you wrote poetry, Lissa.
I do. I'm a published poet, not a book, but actual poems and literary magazines and stuff. You can Google it, Gary. It'll be all good.
I will. I'm sorry. Because I have read both of your books, and the Good Luck Cat is one of my favorite books of all time.
Thank you.
And I love baseball. It's interesting how baseball is such an intellectual sport. There are a lot of books about baseball and not quite as many about, you know, golf or badminton.
Or football, even really very few, I feel like. Yeah. But don't diss badminton. It's quite the sport. I like it.
I went to the championships in Paris. Several people were killed.
Are you serious? When was this?
No, I'm not serious at all.
Goodness.
What else have you been reading?
Well, this book is a little bit wonky, but okay. In a good way. It's called Next Generation Compliance. And the subtitle is Environmental Regulation for the Modern Era. And it's by a woman named Cynthia Giles, is published by Oxford University Press. They came out with it in September. During the Obama administration, as a Senate-confirmed presidential appointee, Cynthia Giles headed EPA's Office of Enforcement and Compliance Assurance, and that was their largest division. In her book, she explains that violations of environmental regulations can result in a host of issues that affect human health, not to mention their deleterious effects on the planet. As importantly, Cynthia Giles shows that the serious violations of environmental regulations are quite widespread, and that by far the most important driver of compliance results is not enforcement, but the structure of the rule itself. And then she goes on to explain how to build much better compliance right into the regulations. If it sounds wonky to you, like I said, you're right, it is. But it's gloriously wonky. And guess what? Through the magic of open source, you can download the entire book for free on her website, which is nextgencompliance.org. That's Gen, G-E-N, nextgencompliance.org. So there, free book for you.
Now, is that interfering with book sales that she's giving the book away?
It does and it doesn't. They actually find that a lot of people who download a book for free using open source go on to purchase a printed copy of the book.
Huh, that's fascinating. Well, it's also interesting that I was reading recently that for Republicans, the environment and global warming or whatever they call it now is at the bottom of their list of priorities, and securing the borders is at the top of their list. And for Democrats, the environment is at the top of their list and securing the borders is at the bottom of their list.
That's an interesting flip-flop.
Yeah. I'm not sure why, but...
I'm not sure why either. Can we worry about the environment more? I would like to worry about the environment more.
I would. Yeah.
Not to show my colors.
You go right ahead.
Thank you.
No, I don't care about the borders, and I care a lot about the environment.
Same here, I have to say. But I guess being up in Boston, where we don't really have issues with the border, maybe it's not entirely fair for me to be so dismissive of it. Maybe I'd feel differently if I lived in Texas. Maybe not. I don't know.
Are there not? Maybe there are a lot of Canadians that are sneaking in there.
I don't see it. And you know what? If they want to be here and they can, like, you know, make maple syrup and maybe occasionally speak French to me, I would be totally okay with that.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's how I feel. It doesn't matter what people do. I don't see how it bothers me. But what bothers me is if the world should end before I'm done.
Well, we won't let that happen. We won't let that happen. That's the lovely thing about this book. You really do feel empowered after you read it, because you realize the problem is with the laws themselves, the rules themselves. And if you fix that, then you're going to have compliance. And if you have compliance, then you're going to have a healthier environment. So it's
Is this just a book you've read, or have you worked with Cynthia Giles?
A little bit of both. I have read it. I have worked with her on a little bit of review coverage, trying to get her book to be reviewed in a few, you know, science magazines and environmental policy magazines. The Yale Environmental Law Journal is going to do a big blog symposium about her in the book, with a lot of other people writing in to talk about her points. So keep an eye out for that. That should be in the next few weeks.
All right. I'm going to download the book too, because cool. I can.
Because yes, I can. You can for free. You can.
We got time for another one, if you have another book to mention.
I do. This one is called Saving Grace: What Patients Teach Their Doctors About Life, Death, and the Balance in Between. And it's by David Alfery, MD, and it's coming out in early January from Whippenstock, which is not a publisher that I knew too much about, but they're a good little house, Whippenstock. From the OR to the ICU, cardiac anesthesiologist Dr. David Alfery brings us into a hidden world of medicine. We witness the exhilaration a physician feels when a life is miraculously saved, the terror when a life is on the line, the shock of an unexpected demise, the grace patient's evidence when facing the end of life, and the anguish one suffers when a family member is perilously close to dying, and so much more. Saving Grace shows what really goes on in an acute care medical setting. And the story that Dr. Alfery tells about being in the waiting room for his own daughter's spinal surgery when it takes a bad turn will resonate with any parent who's ever felt helpless when their child has been sick or in danger. So it's much more than just a book about medicine. It's a book about people. It's a book about love. It's a book about faith. It's all in there. David Alfery spent 36 years in private practice, and he served as the president of the Tennessee State Society of Anesthesiologists. He's from Nashville, and he is a professor at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. So he lives this, he practices this, and now for the first time, he's writing about it. This is his debut book.
And is he a good writer?
He actually is. And you know what was really neat to read in his bio on the back of the book? He was an English major, undergraduate. Which tickled me to no end. He went to Tulane, good school, and studied English, and then entered med school at LSU, and that's where he got his medical degree. But he was an English major first and foremost. I love that.
I wonder if he's published any poems.
I don't think he has. Maybe maybe that'll be in his future. I don't know.
But Lisa Warren has, and she's also the author of The Good Luck Cat. I love that book. I think I mentioned it again. It's a medical book too, in a way.
It becomes that in later chapters. That is true.
And it's a marvelous memoir. And you also wrote a book about how to publicize a book.
I did. I wrote a book for authors called The Savvy Author's Guide to Book Publicity. And it tells authors how to go out there and get bookstores to do events for them and their book and how to get media coverage of their book. It's for authors who just want to get a little extra mileage out of that book that they spent all those years writing.
Well, listen, Warren, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I look forward to your next visit. Thanks so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon. This is KSQD, Santa Cruz.